True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
After sharing a celebratory birthday dinner with her family, 57-year-old Susan Sutton and her husband John were attacked in their home by a masked gunman. Because credit cards, jewelry, and cash were found out in the open and undisturbed, investigators believed early on that this was an inside job. John Sutton was a successful civil attorney who had made some enemies over the years. Susan, though, was loved by everyone, or at least that's what most people thought. But when investigators learned that Susan had been involved in an extramarital romance with John's business partner, they thought they may have found a suspect with a strong motive for the crime. When the business partner failed a polygraph, suspicions against him grew even more. Join us at the quiet end for Blinded. The plot to kill John and Susan Sutton seemed to be well planned and professionally carried out, possibly a case of murder for hire. But then who was behind it? The case seemed like it might never be solved until the murder weapon turned up on a man who had long-standing connections to the Sutton family. So here comes Dick with a beer.
Well, we're in Florida for this case, so of course we need a Florida beer. Fortunately, we were in Florida recently, and I sampled some Florida beers. More than one, actually. So this one is from a beer company called Coppertail Brewing Company in Tampa. And the beer in question is Free Drive, which is just a very simple IPA. It's a gold-colored beer, small white head with a little bit of lace. Pleasant aroma, citrus pine, sweet malt. And there's a taste of grapefruit, pine, and caramel. So this is a solid IPA. Not spectacular, not crappy. just a good drinking beer.
Yeah, nothing too special about it, I guess. But it's tasty enough.
Yes, it is.
Okay, well, let's open it up. All right, Dickie, meet me down at the quiet end. There's something a little bit special about today's episode.
Yeah, there's all sorts of people. A lot of them I don't know, but Nate's here.
Hey, Nate. You know, Nate just celebrated a birthday, his 37th, so I think we should dedicate this episode to Nate.
We'll do that, and these are all his buddies at the quiet end, waiting to have some fun with us.
Yes, and I brought beer and snifters for everybody.
All right.
All right.
You're a good party host.
Oh, yes. So I'm going to let you get us started while I just kind of make the rounds and pour the beer.
Okay. We'll just call you Beer Maid.
Okie doke.
So Susan and John Sutton met on a blind date. Must have been successful because they were married a year later. They wanted to have children, but there were fertility issues. And after years of trying and using infertility treatments, they did finally make the decision to pursue adoption. So the happiest day of Susan Sutton's life was when she and John adopted their son Christopher in April of 1979. He was just a few days old. John described young Christopher as a happy, active child who loved his parents.
Yeah, and I guess it went well because 6 years later, the couple adopted their daughter Melissa. Susan had wanted to be a mother for years, and she gave up her job as the head nurse of a surgical ICU to be a full-time mom. So their family of four was complete. The Suttons seemed like a very happy family with two good kids, until their son Christopher began rebelling in his early teens, which is pretty normal.
Yes, it is.
So I think when it started, they didn't think too much of it, until things just got worse and worse. John and Susan took Christopher to his pediatrician, who sent them to a child psychologist. And then they went to a psychiatrist and even tried some medication. Christopher was diagnosed with ADHD, oppositional defiant disorder, and conduct defiant disorder. And over the next 3 years, Christopher was expelled from several different schools for bad behavior.
Well, these aren't great diagnoses.
No, but it's something that they do with a lot of kids. I think they just don't know, and they kind of throw things at the wall and see what sticks,
well,
honestly.
That's one view. But even if he did have all three of these, the treatment's difficult and not very effective often.
Yes, it's very difficult.
Sure is.
John would actually drive Christopher to school in the mornings, but he said that Christopher would just go out the back door and not attend the classes and go out and get into some fairly serious trouble.
Yeah. So Susan and John were shocked and concerned when Christopher and his friends broke into a teacher's house, destroyed property, and spray-painted the walls. That's major vandalism.
Oh, major. They were sued and had to pay out over $50,000 for property damage. My parents would have murdered me. So actually, they seemed to be fairly tolerant. I guess it didn't hurt that they did have enough money to take care of that, which a lot of families wouldn't. But whenever Christopher didn't get what he wanted from his parents, he became violent, and he started threatening them. He actually threatened his sister and mother at gunpoint once, and then another time he held Susan by the neck, threatening to strangle her. The gun he held on them wasn't loaded, but Susan and Melissa didn't know that. They thought it was loaded, and they were quite terrified.
I'm sure they were.
And I'd just say pointing a gun at anyone, loaded or not, is not cool.
Well, it certainly is a threatening gesture, right?
Absolutely, and I feel like you never quite know. There could be a bullet in there somewhere.
Yeah.
Now that might reveal some of my ignorance with firearms, but you know what I mean.
I do.
Yeah.
Well, and I'm also thinking they've been through all this stuff with this kid. It might be time to look into residential treatment.
Well, yes, but it's not easy.
Oh, no.
When Christopher was 16, Susan found a note in his bedroom and was shocked to find that this was a plan to kill both of his parents in order to inherit their money. So when confronted, Christopher said, oh, no, he'd only been kidding and the plan was not a serious one. But they didn't believe him. Susan and John were really very afraid of their son at that point.
Well, I don't think there was anything to make him not afraid. You've discussed or gone over just a few of the things he's done to the household. There's probably many, many more instances of Christopher, shall we say, misbehaving.
Yes, I would think so. So they really decided they had to get him out of the house. It wasn't only them. They did have a young daughter who was, I think, around 9. There's like a 7-year age difference.
Yeah, I think 6 or 7.
Yeah, young girl.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Christopher's friend at the time, Eric Polk, actually told the 48 Hours news program that Christopher's parents may have tended to overreact a bit.
Jeez. So having a gun pointed at you and finding notes that you're thinking of killing your parents, that's overreaction?
Well, I don't know if Eric believes that that really happened. There was a little bit of disagreement there.
Yeah. Okay.
Because Christopher actually moved in with Eric and his family after the restraining order was issued. And according to Eric, Christopher went to school and didn't get into any trouble while he was living with him and his family.
Yeah, see, he's a model citizen all of a sudden.
So the thought was, wait, is there something wrong at Christopher's home that's either making him act out or perhaps his parents are just alarmists? And that seemed to be the thinking of Eric. Now, I'm not sure what Eric's parents would say about this because I haven't found any interviews with them.
Yeah, they might not have the same story.
They might not. But just 3 weeks after he'd moved in with Eric, 2 men showed up at Eric's house and took Christopher away. So what happened here was Susan and John shipped him off to this hardcore behavior modification school for troubled boys. And it was located in Samoa. And this school was called Paradise Cove. Discipline at Paradise Cove was very severe, and it included isolation in a wooden box for up to 24 hours.
Yeah, and also according to students who were at Paradise Cove, there were even more severe punishments that could be doled out, including being hogtied with duct tape and left in a secluded location. Because Christopher was very angry with his parents for sending him into the Samoan Behavior Modification Program, it might be a good idea to spend a few minutes discussing the history, along with the alleged abuses in these kinds of programs.
So these types of schools or programs, whatever you want to call them, really have quite a history that's very disturbing.
Yeah, they sure do.
So we looked into the Worldwide Association of Specialty Programs, aka WWASP. So this is a corporation that was behind many teen behavior modification programs, teen boot camps, and therapeutic boarding schools. Paradise Cove was one of these programs. After being created in the early 1990s, WWASP became one of the largest troubled teen industry businesses, with dozens of facilities in the U.S. and in other countries, including Mexico, Costa Rica, and Samoa. So following investigations into multiple allegations of child abuse and dangerous conditions at these facilities since 2002, over 20 WWASP-affiliated programs were eventually shut down. The organization was also dissolved. Multiple lawsuits were filed against the corporation related to alleged abuse and fraud. So 350 plaintiffs filed a joint action lawsuit where they claimed to have been physically and sexually abused in these programs. And the corporation was also accused of fraud and racketeering.
So while many schools and programs formerly associated with WWASP have tried to separate themselves from the organization, many are still operating and continue to engage in the same old deceptive marketing practices. Some even operate in the same facilities that they used to be in, and they even have the same ownership and employees. So a lot of these places, business as usual.
Well, they're definitely money-making ventures, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely.
And whenever you're trying to make money off something like this, I think it can be a recipe for disaster.
Well, if the staff deals with troubled teens with increasing levels of violence and aggression,
yes,
obviously that's not going to be much of a help.
Well, yeah, I think there was a lot of untrained staff and also many staff who were just abusive. So the specific program where Christopher was taken to was Paradise Cove, and this opened in the early 1990s in the island nation of Western Samoa. And this was an all-male program which housed about 450 teen boys at its peak.
The facility was reported to have closed in 1998 by the U.S. State Department, but according to the WWASP Survivors Group website, that ain't true.
Mm-hmm.
State Department did investigate the facility and issued a statement advising parents not to send their children there. But the State Department has no power to regulate or close overseas schools.
Well, and I think that's part of the reason why they were located there.
Yeah.
Much less regulation than if they were doing it in the United States. And of course, family members can't as easily check up on what's going on. So that's a problem.
Big problem. Now, this place, Paradise Cove, was eventually closed by the Samoan government, citing child abuse as the reason. There were several cases of teens suffering food poisoning and being hospitalized, and that prompted the initial investigation of Paradise Cove. All of the teens remaining at Paradise Cove were sent to other WWASP facilities. Paradise Cove was one of the most notorious WWASP schools because of the primitive conditions and just the severe brutality at the school.
Yeah, in a blog written by a survivor of Paradise Cove, this survivor describes incidents of beating, electrocution, horrendous sanitation conditions, and resulting illnesses. And he also explains how the staff pushed the older students to bully and abuse the younger students. So you not only had staff abusing students, you had a whole culture of abuse.
Yeah, we're working on bullying.
So in complaints filed with attorneys in Samoa, campers have said that they were assaulted by staff and made to live without running water or proper sanitation. So these could be a real nightmare. And from everything I've read at Paradise Cove, I believe that it was a really tough place to be.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question about that.
No, I think Christopher was probably seen by his parents as quite spoiled. They'd given him quite a lot, and he expected a lot. So I can see how they would think sending him to kind of a tough love program might straighten him out. But on the other hand, it may have had the opposite effect.
It may have. We don't know how much research the Suttons did on this place, or if they looked at alternative places. Don't know any of that.
No, and just because they researched it doesn't mean they necessarily found out the truth about it.
That's true.
There were actually many places that were recommending that you send your child to one of these programs. And I'm wondering if there were some kickbacks. There has been some evidence of that in some cases.
Well, sure, there could have been.
So, just a very warped situation overall. So, another thing, Dick, is that these kids weren't just there for a week or two or a few months. This was long-term stuff.
This was.
Which I think could really break apart the family unit. I think in a lot of successful psychological programs for troubled young people, the parents are part of the program.
Right. It's like a group counseling session.
Exactly. You need to know how to live with your family. So I'm not really impressed with this choice. I don't know how much I can judge how they made the choice, because they may have been very misled. But I just think sending him so far away for such a long period of time did not turn out to be a positive thing. Especially since it turned out to be such a horrible place.
Right. I don't see how it could give you any positives about it. It's at the other side of the globe.
Exactly.
So it's not like the Suttons are going to be going down there each weekend to visit with Christopher. And it's certainly, if there is any family programs or anything like that, they're not going to be there for that.
Well, and I don't think there really was much family involvement in this program.
No, it sounds to me like it's a prison, basically.
Yes. And it's unfortunate. Now, Christopher was at Paradise Cove for a full year when he sent a video message back home to his parents. And in the message, he told them that he didn't feel like they loved him. And he felt like they were just putting him there to get him out of their hair. Now, Susan, John, and Christopher's sister, Melissa, did travel to Samoa to visit him and to see what the program was like. And most families didn't do that. Of course, it's an expense. These programs ranged from $2,000 to $3,000 a month, which is really hard for many families to afford. That, in addition to traveling there to see him, is just beyond the means of many families.
Yeah, it is.
But not in the case of the Suttons. All three of the family members did travel there to visit Christopher. But this was a planned visit, and it seems that the staff was prepared. Because John and Susan apparently did not see any of these abuses or poor conditions. According to John, Christopher was very happy to see his family, probably hopeful that they were going to take him home. Christopher told his parents about abuses he had endured in the program, but John himself said they just didn't believe him. Now I could see how this would really anger Christopher.
Yes.
First of all, they've sent him so far away. I think it's very dismissive. I don't think this was the best way to handle it. And then the fact that they didn't believe him when he said he was abused, that just breaks the trust more within the family.
Yeah, it's not a help, is it?
No. So then Christopher just kind of knew he was going to be there until he was 18. But he thought on his 18th birthday, he would return home. And that's what he looked forward to for months.
Yeah, well, when he's 18, he's an adult.
Well, that's what he thought. But remember, John was a very good lawyer. And he was able to get a court order to keep Christopher there for another full year until he was 19. And John's reasoning for this was that Christopher was fighting the program. So we don't know if this is just John's judgment, that he thought Christopher was not going along with the program, or maybe this is what someone in the staff had told him in order to keep him for another year.
Sure. Because Paradise Cove would have a reason for keeping him. They make another year's money off of the parents.
Exactly. And Christopher wasn't really consulted about this. So as you can imagine, he became even more angry and bitter.
Yeah, but ultimately he did get to go home when he turned 19. And he seemed to be a loving son once he arrived back home, at least to begin with.
Well, that's what John and Susan thought. Actually, they took the family on a cruise shortly after he returned home. a little bit of a celebration. Christopher was 19, and on the cruise, he met 17-year-old Juliet, who would become his girlfriend and his fiancée. Juliet was treated like a daughter by both John and Susan, and John even gave her a job answering phones in his law office. Susan and Christopher also worked there. Christopher did kind of odd jobs, but Susan, who had been an RN, provided medical consultations for many of the civil cases that the firm handled. So Susan and John, it seems like they pretty much supported Juliet and Christopher.
Oh yeah, they've employed them. I think they gave him an apartment to live in, right?
Yeah, rent-free apartment.
Good.
Jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And Juliet said that she felt loved by Christopher's parents and believed that they only wanted the best for the young couple. And that's probably true. I think they were hoping that Christopher would be successful. And they didn't have really like highfalutin ideas that Christopher had to be a lawyer. They just wanted him to be stable and have a job that he liked and be a happy young man, which seems very appropriate to me.
Yes, it does.
So things went along that way, and when Christopher was 25, he appeared to be this very loving son. He did get angry with his parents, but only when he wasn't given what he wanted from them. And usually he was given what he wanted. But whenever they'd put their foot down and tell him no, he'd get very angry. So there's still a big problem there.
It would seem, yes. And according to Juliet, his fiancée, Christopher had an argument with his mother just days before someone broke into the Sutton home and shot John and Susan.
Yeah, I think a big thing I'm going to want to talk about as we get more into this is Juliet and what she knew. Because I have a hard time believing she didn't know more than she will say that she knew about this. But yeah, we'll get more into that.
Okay.
Let's stay on our timeline and let's go to August 22nd, 2004. This was just 2 days after Susan's 57th birthday. And she, John, Christopher, Juliet, and John's law partner, Teddy Montoto, had a dinner together in the Sutton home to celebrate Susan's birthday. And also the fact that John and Teddy had gotten a settlement on a case for over $1 million.
Hey, ka-ching, ka-ching.
Now that night, Christopher and Juliet had plans to see a movie, so they left the get-together right after dinner. And shortly after they left, Teddy Montoto went home.
So they're alone. Susan and John watched the Olympics on TV for a while. And then around 10 o'clock, they decided to go to bed. They slept in separate bedrooms because John's snoring bothered Susan, so she'd been sleeping in Christopher's old room because he was such a loud snorer.
Okay. Now I always have a bit of an issue with this. I think if a married couple's sleeping in separate rooms, there's often more to it than that. There's a distance there.
Yeah, I know that's probably not a scientific experiment, right?
No, but I don't have any data.
But I would get that impression that no matter what, I mean, our daughter was doing that with her ex-husband now. He snored and had a CPAP machine, and she said that she couldn't stand it and slept in another room. Now, we've since learned that their problems went a lot deeper than that.
That's true.
And here we have this couple. He's a loud snorer. I'm going to sleep in the other room. I'd guess that there's something going on. Well, we know there's something going on. She's having an affair. You've already told us that.
That's true. Yes. But we don't know if they were angry at each other, or if they were just becoming distant. But it seems that John did not know that Susan was having an extramarital affair. So the two went off to bed in separate rooms. And John was sitting on the edge of the bed getting ready when a gunman walked into his room. This man was wearing all black, and John did not recognize him. And the man immediately began shooting, actually breaking a mirror on the headboard. And John got shot, rolled off the bed, and fell onto the floor. Then the gunman went to the bedroom where Susan was and shot her 6 times. Then he returned to the master bedroom where John was lying on the floor and shot him until the gun was empty. The gunman then left, assuming that John was dead, which seems a pretty fair assumption if you shoot somebody twice in the head. So I'm just thinking, you know, if he's shot twice in the head and shot other areas of his body, certainly seems like he would have been killed.
Yeah. I mean, he had several gunshot wounds, including two to the head. You figure he's dead. He's gone.
Yeah, so the gunman left the house. John knew, though, that he had been shot in the head and he was bleeding profusely. Still, he was alive, which is amazing. I mean, what are the odds, really?
Pretty tiny.
I would think so.
Not only was he alive, he was somehow able to get to the telephone and call 911.
Well, that's another thing. He didn't have severe brain damage or anything, which is really remarkable.
Yeah, it is.
So he called 911, and if you listen to the 911 call, which is pretty brief, John sounds very controlled and almost calm on the call. He calmly told the dispatcher that someone had come into his house and shot him, and he asked for the police and an ambulance. Now, he couldn't see it all, though, because the shots to his head and the damage that had been done would leave him blinded.
So when the police arrived at the Sutton home, Susan had been shot to death in her bedroom. John, though, had survived. He was taken to the hospital for treatment. When police surveyed the crime scene, they were surprised to find nothing else disturbed in the house. So there was expensive jewelry, watches, credit cards, and cash, all of them pretty much in plain view. So the police figured clearly this is not a burglary. It seems to be or have been a planned execution.
Well, yeah, another thing is there was no sign of a break-in. The back sliding door out to the pool was unlocked, which wasn't something that they normally left unlocked. So although John would survive, he was in critical condition, as you can imagine, and a priest was actually called in to give him his last rites. He had been shot multiple times, like I said, including two times in his head. One of his fingers had actually been shot off, and he had other injuries on his arm and his torso. So John and Susan's daughter, who at this point was an 18-year-old college freshman, came to the hospital to see her dad, and he was almost unrecognizable to her. She was told that her mother was dead, but then a decision was made not to tell John until his condition was improved, because of course this would be very upsetting to him.
Yeah, and they didn't want to do anything that would jeopardize his recovery.
Sure. So I think that's a reasonable decision.
Yeah.
So John did wake up. He was in the ICU. He was blind. And of course, he was in severe pain. He couldn't think of anyone who would want to kill him, but he still felt like he was in danger and maybe the gunman would come back to the hospital and kill him. He just didn't know. So it was pretty terrifying.
Yeah, Miami detectives knew that the shooting had been pre-planned and was not a robbery gone wrong. They interviewed John, but his memory remained pretty sketchy. All he could say for sure about the gunman was that he was either wearing black or he was a black man. He just couldn't be sure. Detectives hoped that John's law partner would be more helpful. That's Teddy Montoto.
Well, sure. But when interviewed, Teddy said that he had been on the phone with Susan when he heard the gunshots, and then he had sped over to the Sutton's house, and he arrived just minutes after the police and first responders had. When told that Susan had died, Teddy was very emotional and upset, according to the detectives. But Teddy told them that he was a competitive shooter and that he had been shooting a gun earlier that day, which they thought was kind of an odd thing to bring up right away when something like this had happened, right?
Yeah, you think?
Because it kind of rules out that they can do any testing for gunshot residue. Is that what he was getting at? They really weren't sure.
Well, if I'm a police officer, that's something I'd be thinking.
Yes, I think they definitely were looking at him because he was on the phone with his business partner's wife late at night was a little bit odd. And then how he got there right after they did and told them that he had shot a gun that day.
Well, and look at the other thing. They all had dinner that night. This is Susan's birthday, a family celebration. And then Teddy's like the fifth wheel.
I suppose. I don't know. He's his business partner and they all work together. I don't really have an issue with that. I guess it could be a little bit unusual.
I think so.
Yeah?
We don't know if Teddy was married or not, right?
I don't think he was, but no, I really don't know for sure.
I would think that if you have your business partner to a family celebration, the business partner would bring his wife or significant other.
I would think so, too, and that's why I've kind of made this assumption that he wasn't married, although I can't 100% say that to you. But in nothing that I've read or watched have I heard anything about him having a wife. So Teddy had also brought up that shooting was his hobby. He gave them his gun, though, and they sent it for immediate testing. Of course, they're interested in him. Meanwhile, detectives pushed him to give more information about that late-night phone call with Susan. Now, remember, John's in the hospital and Susan's dead, so they really can't speak to John. He's not capable at this point. And they're trying to get as much as they can from Teddy. But they believe that he was not being forthcoming, and they started to think he was hiding something from them. And it turns out he was.
Turns out he was. Montoto was asked to take a polygraph exam, and he consented to that. But then he failed the exam. Now, his deceptive answers were the answers he had given in regards to his relationship with Susan. Montoto was interrogated for hours and finally revealed his secret. He was involved in a sexual relationship with Susan. Well, that would certainly make him a suspect, wouldn't it?
Well, it would at least give him a motive to kill John. And if there had been some kind of a love triangle, I think it's possible that he could have wanted both of the Suttons dead, or something could have happened that night, right? Some kind of confrontation. But then it turned out that Teddy Montoto's gun did not match the bullets that had killed Susan and grievously injured John. Also, Montoto had an alibi. So it was determined that he had failed the polygraph simply because he was hiding his affair with his law partner's wife, Susan. So who else would have a motive to kill the Suttons? Teddy and John had been very successful in their practice, but they'd also made some enemies through their civil litigation, and John had received death threats before, actually several of them.
I'd also, just as an aside, I think it's a pretty shitty thing that this guy's partner, they work together, and he's screwing his wife.
Oh, it's totally shitty. I agree. It's shitty of Susan just as much.
It is.
Yeah.
So that's my one editorial comment.
I would think so, because I think this Teddy Montoto was quite a bit younger than them, right? He was in his 30s or so.
Okay.
So Susan was kind of having some fun, I guess, with a younger man. But we don't know what was going on in the Suttons' marriage. Obviously, there were issues there, I believe, because I believe if you're sleeping in separate bedrooms, there's probably more to it than just snoring. And with that, I don't mean that, oh, your spouse is snoring really loud, you're not going to go into the guest room here and there. But if you're actually making it a habit of sleeping in another room from bedtime on, I just see a real lack of intimacy that a marriage kind of needs to survive. Everyone who had threatened John was investigated, but it turned out that they all had alibis. And next, detectives began interviewing all of John's friends and colleagues. Among some of John's closest friends, one name kept coming up as a suspect, and it was a surprising one. It was his son, Christopher Sutton.
I don't know why that's surprising.
He's told him
he's going to kill him.
Well, years ago, I believe.
Yes.
But I don't think you normally think that a son's going to kill his parents. It's very kind of unusual.
No, that's true.
And now at this point, he'd been an adult. He'd been working for them. He has his own place. He has a fiance. I think he was at least giving the impression to the outside that he was fairly well adjusted and things were going okay between family members. So it was really unusual to detectives for so many people to be pointing fingers at John and Susan's son. Now remember, Christopher at this point is 25 years old. After John was released from the hospital, Christopher was the one who took care of his father. He'd actually been at his side like a loyal son. So John moved in with Christopher. But the police were hearing disturbing stories from several sources about Christopher and his behavior. Christopher had said many times to different people that he wanted his parents dead. And that came out. Also, there was that time I mentioned earlier where he had choked his mother, and the time he had pointed a rifle at his mother and sister. Yes, the gun had not been loaded, but Christopher had told Susan and Melissa that it was loaded, and of course they'd been terrified. They had felt threatened that he might actually shoot them to death.
I think those are reasonable thoughts.
Well, sure. So I'm not sure exactly what John and Susan thought about Christopher on that night. Who knows? Because there had been an argument just a couple nights earlier.
Right.
And that had been because Susan would not pay Christopher's car insurance bill. So I'm not sure what that was about. But he's living rent-free. They're doing a lot for him. She might have said, you know what? I'm not going to do that. You need to start taking some responsibility, which is reasonable.
Yeah, that might have been a trigger.
Oh, absolutely. No. I don't think it took a lot to trigger him at that point.
No.
Now, one person who was firmly on the side of suspecting Christopher was Susan's sister, Mary. Now, John did not agree with her. And once he was alert and oriented, Mary started urging him not to move in with Christopher because she felt certain that Christopher had had something to do with Susan's murder and with shooting John. But actually, John was defensive. He defended his son and became very angry with Mary. John felt that Christopher was a loving son now, and of course, he didn't want Christopher to be the one involved in his wife's murder. It's bad enough. His wife is murdered, and he's blinded, and they've gone through all this. But to think that their own son did it.
Yeah, that'd be a crusher, wouldn't it?
That would have to be just soul-crushing. Especially since, whatever you think of them sending him to Paradise Cove, they did have good intentions there. Their intention was for him to be a happy, constructive adult. It's not like they sent him there just to punish him.
Well, I'm not so sure about that, but anyway.
No? Well, I don't know. I think if parents send one of their children there, they're hoping when he comes back, he's going to be better. And I'm thinking that generation, really a lot of people of that generation believe that hardship builds character, which in some ways it does. But then when hardship moves on to abuse, that's a whole different story.
It is.
But just from what I've heard from John and I've read, it seems like at least John believed that this was a good thing for Christopher. It was going to kind of make, you know, a more responsible man out of him.
Yes, hopefully.
Yeah, so that's what he thought. John thought that Christopher had gotten the therapy he needed or the discipline, whatever, and now he was doing better. Maybe not perfect, probably not anywhere close to perfect, but better. They really liked his fiancée and they had hopes. Well, according to Susan's sister Mary, she began to seriously look at Christopher on the day before Susan's funeral, so pretty early on. She said that Christopher was describing how the crime took place, you know, in detail. And he seemed very familiar with the details that had not been released by the police to the public. But Christopher had an alibi. He was at the movies with Juliet when the shooting happened. So we know that he couldn't have physically been the shooter. Still, he may have hired someone to kill his parents, and that's what Mary thought.
Sure. Now, Juliet said that she was in shock when she heard about Susan's murder and the attempt to kill John that left him blinded. Juliet also claimed that Christopher seemed devastated when he heard about the crime. John and Susan had treated her like a daughter, Juliet said, and they did everything they could, everything in their power, to support her and Christopher.
Right. So at that point, Juliet is saying that she doesn't think Christopher was behind this.
Right.
But we're going to find out more, which makes me question that. So Detective Rosanna Cardero spoke with Christopher a short time after he'd been notified of his mother's death. Now she said she did see him tear up a little bit. But then she was really surprised when he immediately showed her his movie tickets to prove his alibi. And she said this isn't something she'd ever seen before. When she notified someone of a loved one's murder, usually the first thought is not to give their alibi.
No, the first thought is to grieve a little bit, huh?
I would think, a lot. It was an odd thing to do, but Christopher would claim that he only did that because he'd heard from Teddy Montoto about his interrogation, which had been pretty strong interrogation on him. because he was probably their first big suspect.
Oh, sure. So, and Christopher figured that he's going to get out in front of this. He'll show them the movie tickets and they'll stop questioning him.
Yeah. I don't know how I feel about that. I think it's possible that someone would do that. But on the other hand, I think if you're completely innocent and you've lost someone you love in a sudden violent crime, that's not something that's going to even enter your mind. Not that early on, anyway.
Right. So CCTV footage from the movie theater where Christopher and Juliet had been was recovered and examined by the police. Christopher can be seen leaving the theater with Juliet a few minutes before midnight. So the timeline works for him in terms of being responsible for the murder.
Yeah, he definitely has an alibi. But one thing that Detective Cardero noticed was that as soon as Christopher walked out of that theater, he was on his cell phone. And she thought that was suspicious. Was he checking to see if the murder had been done? That's the feeling she got from it. And if that's the case, how could Juliet not know?
So the police got a warrant for Christopher's cell phone records, and they noticed right away that Christopher had exchanged over 300 calls with one particular phone number in the weeks before and immediately after Susan's murder. That's a bunch.
That's a lot.
I don't think I text you 300 times in a year.
Well, yeah, and we rarely call each other, but we are both home together a lot.
Yes, we are. So, and this was the number, the number where all the calls have been going to. This is the number Christopher had called on his way out of the theater.
So that's significant.
That's significant.
Absolutely.
And this phone number was identified as belonging to a guy named Garrett Kopp.
Mm-hmm. Now, Garrett Kopp had been arrested less than 24 hours after the shooting at the Sutton House for assaulting someone with a gun in another area of Miami. Kopp was out on bail, but a detective on the Sutton case contacted the arresting officer. The arresting officer had possession of Kopp's gun. So they got the gun, and after testing by ballistics, that gun was found to be a match to the gun that was used to kill Susan and shoot John. So that was a major breakthrough.
Big time. They got him.
So he'd shot these two people, and then he'd gone somewhere else and assaulted someone with the same gun, hadn't gotten rid of it. So I don't think Garrett Kopp is going to be winning any awards for intelligence or kindness.
That would be true. So Kopp was interrogated for over 6 hours before he confessed to the crime. But Kopp also asked the police to protect him. He was the shooter, but he said he only did it because Christopher Sutton had threatened to kill both him and his son. He said that the idea to kill Christopher's parents was all Christopher's. Christopher had gotten the gun, he had sketched out the layout of the house for Kopp, and he had also left the sliding back door unlocked so Kopp could enter.
Yeah, so he gave it up pretty quickly, but then tried to turn it around like he only did it because he was threatened. But that certainly wasn't going to get him out of trouble.
No, maybe a little less trouble.
Maybe, but it's still going to be first-degree murder.
Yeah. But he probably would provide testimony against Christopher.
Well, yeah, that's something he'll have to do to save himself from the electric chair.
That's right.
Right? This is Florida.
It's Florida.
They don't fuck around. They like to kill people. So Kopp had gone directly to the bedrooms where Susan and John were that night, and he'd shot them. Susan had hidden under the covers when he fired, and he didn't remember how many times he had shot each of the parents. But there were gunshot holes through Susan's comforter. So he was giving information about the crime scene that only the police and the killer should have known. So Garrett Kopp was arrested, but investigators knew that they needed more than just his word to implicate Christopher and arrest him. So detectives sought out anyone who might have known about the murder plan, and they brought in Christopher's fiancée, Juliet, for further questioning. Because they're thinking, she has to know something.
Well, they live together.
She had to know something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Juliet denied knowing anything about Christopher's plans to murder his parents. After 13 hours of questioning, which was not audio or video recorded, Juliet told the detectives what she did know about Christopher's relationship with his parents. She said she was aware that Christopher resented his parents for sending him to that Samoan school, and for not giving him everything he wanted. Because remember, they're pretty much supporting him. But even that wasn't enough for him.
No, it certainly wasn't. According to Juliet, Christopher believed that he was entitled to anything he wanted from them. It didn't matter to Christopher that they were paying his rent, his bills, giving him employment, and even taking him and his fiancée on vacations. Christopher had told Juliet that he could find someone to kill his parents. Now remember, they'd been together a long time. She'd been with him since he was 19. And she would say that she had been listening to him talking about killing his parents for 6 years. He told her that after his parents were dead, life would be good for them. They would inherit half of the family fortune, and they could do whatever they wanted, and they'd never have to worry about money again. But for some reason, Juliet wasn't that alarmed about that. Maybe she'd heard it so much she decided he wasn't serious. That's what she tried to imply in police interviews. So when she spoke with investigators, she claimed that she'd never told anyone about his talking about killing his parents because she thought he didn't really mean it. She talked to...
He's been doing it for several years. He didn't really mean it?
Well, he's been doing it for years and he's never done it.
Okay.
Right?
Well, that's good logic to that, too.
I guess. Now, she talked about the argument that she had witnessed between Susan and Christopher that happened just days before the murder shooting. Susan had refused to pay Christopher's car insurance bill, and according to Juliet, Christopher was absolutely furious about this. And part of the reason he was so angry is because he had just learned about a settlement of over $1 million that John's law firm had won, and he was just livid that Susan wouldn't pay such a minor bill for him. So he didn't seem able to see that that was money his father had earned. And maybe he didn't have a right to it.
Well, I don't know. He looks at it as what's yours is mine.
Well, yes, he apparently did. So there was some confusion there, I guess.
And after speaking with Juliet, detectives felt they had enough to get a warrant for the arrest of Christopher. But they couldn't find him. As they looked for him, Detective Cardero went to tell John what was happening with the case. Because they were afraid that Christopher was still planning to get rid of his father, the detective instructed John to lock his doors and stay inside the house.
Yeah, Detective Cardero was truly afraid that Christopher might try and kill his father again, because he still wanted the inheritance. But she was also dreading telling this to John, who'd recently lost his wife after all, and his sight. So now he's going to find out that his son was behind this? Devastating. So when she got to John's house, Cardero told him that she had to tell him something that would be very difficult for him to hear. Then she explained how all of the evidence was leading back to his son. Now, understandably, John was very upset and shocked. But he would say that after he heard the evidence, it all made sense to him. And once he heard that Garrett Kopp had confessed, well, then he knew it had to be true. Because Christopher and Garrett had been very close friends for years, and Christopher had been kind of the leader in the relationship. Garrett was 5 years younger than Christopher, and he'd been hanging out with Christopher since he was 15 years old. So shortly after Christopher had gotten back from Samoa, these two had become friends. So Christopher was on the run for 2 weeks before police caught up with him and they arrested him. The police made a deal with Kopp. Not a great deal, though. I mean, they took the death penalty off the table in exchange for his testimony. But in his deal, he still received 30 years in prison.
Well, early 20s, the early 50s when he gets out.
Yeah, but when you're in your 20s, that is forever.
Yeah.
And being in your 50s is old.
Well, okay.
You know, so it's not easy. It's not a great deal. Although, I guess if you're afraid of getting the electric chair.
If you don't make the deal, you're going to face the electric chair.
Right. So it's either bad or worse is all he could really choose from here.
Probably. So Christopher's attorney portrayed Garrett Kopp as a petty criminal and drug addict with a propensity for violence. He said that Kopp had lied about Christopher's involvement just so he could get a lighter sentence. In court, Kopp said that Christopher had promised him a payment of $100,000 for committing the crime. And Christopher's defense was that he's lying.
Yeah, so basically, Garrett's saying that Christopher wanted him to do it and arrange the whole thing. And Christopher's saying, no, Garrett's just a drug addict who's making this up. So Christopher went to trial for murder. When Christopher's trial began, John Sutton was there, but he sat far away from his son. So he's not forgiving his son or on his son's side like some parents have been in this type of circumstances. He's having none of it. Prosecutors told the jury how close Garrett Kopp and Christopher Sutton had been. And it came out that after Christopher returned from Samoa, he sold drugs for money, even though his father was giving him plenty of money to support himself. So it doesn't seem like Christopher learned anything at all, except maybe how to be a worse human being. The plan, prosecutors said, was for Kopp to kill Susan and John, and then, after Christopher got his inheritance, he would pay Kopp his $100,000. So that was the deal these two made. So at trial, Garrett Kopp took the stand in his prison clothes and shackles. He testified about Christopher wanting his parents dead and that he had offered to pay Kopp to do that. The defense had to prove that Kopp was a liar in order to get Christopher acquitted. So they focused on the interrogation that Kopp endured and suggested that the police had pressured and intimidated him. But coming up with an independent motive for Kopp to do the shooting really proved difficult, and that was a problem for the defense.
Yeah, they weren't going to be able to show any animosity between Kopp and Christopher's parents.
No, and nothing had been stolen. So yeah. If he was a drug addict, why wouldn't he have taken the money?
That's right.
When he went in.
All that stuff lying around at the house.
Yeah, if the motive was for money for drugs, that doesn't add up to the crime.
Nope. So the prosecution had information that this was not the first time Christopher had tried to kill his parents.
Yeah, so this was really something.
An ex-con named Jose Pion testified that he had met Christopher back in 1999, about a year after his return from Samoa. He said that Christopher had asked him back then if he knew any hitmen who would kill his parents for him. Pion went to say that Christopher had told him that his parents had $1 million plus property and life insurance.
So this looked really bad. That was an important witness.
Yeah, but there's now, more coming.
Sure, but I mean, Pion is an ex-con, so maybe not the most credible witness. And he really didn't have anything specific that Christopher had told him that he couldn't otherwise know. So that was a bit of a problem. But other than that, he did seem pretty believable because he said that he had told Christopher no interest in doing that.
Yeah.
Whatever he had done, he wasn't a killer. Then a detective took the stand and testified that after he was shown Juliet's statement, Christopher had put his head down, cried, and said, "I'm fucked." And this was seen as an admission of guilt. But according to Christopher, he only cried then because he believed the police were setting him up, even though he was innocent.
And Juliet testified for the prosecution. She said that Christopher called his mother a fucking bitch because she didn't give him everything he deserved as far as money. She also testified about how angry Christopher was about being sent to Samoa and how he believed that his parents deserved to die.
Well, now that's a drastic statement.
It sure is. But then on cross by the defense, Juliet said that she only gave the police incriminating information about Christopher after they had threatened her with arrest. She said she didn't know if Christopher was actually behind the killing because she was confused.
Okay, but she does remember him saying he wanted his parents dead on several occasions.
Yeah, and she did admit to the prosecutor that everything she had told them was true.
Exactly.
She did maintain that she never thought Christopher would actually go through with the murder.
Well, yeah, a lot of people think that, right?
Sure.
Because some people say, I'm going to kill this person, and they're just saying that to blow off steam or whatever. But I think it's a little different with Christopher. Susan's sister Mary said Christopher just wasn't right. In her mind, there was something missing with him as far as being able to connect with people emotionally. So she saw him as a bit of a sociopath. After hearing all this evidence, John Sutton felt certain that Christopher was responsible. He did take the stand, and he explained what had happened on August 22, 2004, as well as the extent of his injuries. John testified about Christopher complaining about money after he returned from Samoa, And even after the shooting, John said, Christopher wanted more money from him. After bringing John home from the hospital, Christopher had wanted to take control of the finances. But John still didn't really trust his son, did he? Because he didn't want Christopher's name on any of his bank accounts.
That's a good thought.
So I'm a little confused because John said he thought at age 25, Christopher was a loving son. But at the same time, he didn't trust him with money. So that's a little bit confusing to me. What do you think? Is that normal?
Yeah, I think until the father can work things out in his own mind, he'll take Christopher's side.
Well, yeah, which I think a parent should probably do that.
Yeah, but then once he found out what the truth was, that was it.
Yeah, and in interviews after all of this, John told the 48 Hours correspondent that he no longer loves his son, and he really can't connect the loving child that Christopher was to the cold adult he became. So it's really a heartbreaker there.
Yeah, Christopher took the stand in his own defense. In his mind, the case came down to his word versus the word of Garrett Kopp. Christopher called Garrett Kopp a drug fiend who had been calling him all day on August 22, 2004, asking for drugs. According to Christopher, he kept drugs in the closet of his old bedroom, where his mother often slept, and he said Garrett knew about it. Now, in a box up on that closet shelf, Christopher said he kept about 2 pounds of marijuana, worth about $7,000.
So this, to me, seems like a motive that Christopher and his attorney had worked out.
Right.
To give to Garrett so that it wouldn't look like he hired him. But there's no evidence that that marijuana was there or that Garrett Kopp took it.
But Christopher said Garrett had been calling him all day looking for drugs. And the police already have over 300 calls between the two of them over time.
Yes.
So that doesn't go along with just a quick burglary.
No, and it's not like Garrett was the one making all the calls to Christopher. They went both ways.
Right.
Christopher claimed that Garrett must have broken into the house for those drugs, and once inside, he panicked when he saw that Susan and John were still awake, and he shot them. And Christopher claimed he had no reason to want his parents dead. He said he was over his anger about being sent to Samoa, and had decided long ago that his parents had sent him there to help him. So he even said that he believed his time in Samoa had been good for him and had changed him into a better person. But when he was questioned about the abuse he had endured at this teen program, he became really emotional and really cried. But that worked against him because he hadn't cried at all when he was discussing his mother's murder or his father being shot. So he's really breaking down and crying about being in Samoa and what he had to endure there. But his mother's death, not so much. And of course, the prosecutor would have pointed that out.
You bet.
So because the only real emotional reaction seen by him on the stand was his reaction to what he had gone through, the prosecution made the conclusion that Christopher really only cared about himself. And in their closing remarks, they described Christopher as angry, entitled, lazy, and cold-blooded. The defense, on the other hand, focused on the lack of evidence and on Garrett Kopp's lack of credibility. But still, I think things were leaning in the direction of a conviction for Christopher, and I think Christopher knew that.
Well, I don't think it looks real good for him.
No, there's a lot of evidence against him.
And that's what happened. The jury deliberated a day and a half and came back with a verdict of guilty of first-degree murder. And before Christopher was sentenced, John Sutton addressed the court. He did not ask for leniency for his son, and he said that no good outcome could come from this case. He had lost his wife, his son, and his eyesight.
Well, poor Garrett Kopp's father was very emotional as well. He was in tears, blaming himself, and wondering what he'd done wrong to raise a son who turned out to be a murderer. So it's just very sad for everyone. We always think of the victims, of course, and their families and their losses. But I think it's important to remember sometimes that most parents of murderers are just people who did their best to raise their child to be a good person. And it's not always in your control, right? They can give guidance, they can even seek out all the help available, but sometimes you don't have any control over what your child grows up to be. So this is very tragic for him as well, and I did feel some sympathy for Cop's father.
Oh, yes.
As it turns out, nobody was the winner here. Not even Christopher, who thought he would be, I guess. So Christopher was sentenced to life in prison with no chance for parole. His sister Melissa told the 48 Hours correspondent that she will never speak with Christopher again. John Sutton, though, has gone back to practicing law. With an assistant, he's been able to win civil cases just as he did before. So John Sutton did an interview with the Florida Bar Young Lawyers Division, where he spoke about what he'd been through since the shooting. And I've edited this down to just a few minutes because it is a drawn-out interview. But I think it's worth a listen, so I'm going to play that for us now. If you're not interested, it's about 4 or 5 minutes long, and you can fast forward.
My practice was expanding in 2000, 2001, 2, 3, and 4. And my wife was an RN, and she provided medical consultation for us. And in August of 2004, we were looking forward to the fall because we had several very interesting cases set for trial. In particular, August 20th, my wife's birthday, August 22nd, we were having a birthday party at the house, and things were looking very good for the fall. That night, I was watching the Olympics. I had been a swimmer in college. I was watching the swimming and the diving and went to bed after thinking about what I was going to do that particular week. And as I approached the bed and started to get in reclining position, all of a sudden I saw a black hat, black shirt, black pants, and I was launched onto the floor where I believe I passed out. I came to what seemed like a few minutes later and managed to find a telephone, managed to call 911 and stated my name and my address and spelled it, asked for police and ambulance immediately. And at that point in time, I didn't know how badly I was hurt, but I then discovered shortly thereafter that I had suffered 2 bullets to the head through my right temple and out my left jaw. I had also sustained bullet injuries to my left hand, taking off a portion of my finger, my left shoulder, my right thumb, and my right forearm. So I was a mess as I met the police at the front door. They had me walk down the street, got into fire rescue. I remember arriving at Ryder Trauma, and that's just about all I remembered from August 22nd until about September 6th. They explained some pretty complicated surgeries, craniotomy and rebuild my head and my face and so on, and multiple surgeries to my hands. I was invited to go through that on September 6th. My good luck, there was a hurricane about that time, and I said I just couldn't do it. I just wasn't ready. So they reset it to September 10, and I had 14 hours of surgery to redo my head and try and remove the bullet fragments and put me back together. I was very anxious in the hospital because it was obvious that somebody was trying to kill me, and I was begging to get out of the hospital anywhere I could go. I managed to convince everybody to let me out of the hospital by September 14, at which time I went to a condominium where my wife and I had purchased it for my son and his girlfriend to live in the Coconut Grove area. I had lost more than 40 pounds because I couldn't eat. I had a tracheostomy, really could not eat. I was taking this Ensure formula and trying to gain weight. And after I had been there for 4 or 5 days, a friend of mine, Jesse Diner, who was on the Board of Governors and was also on my swim team at Gettysburg College, came in to see me, interviewed me, asked me about our swimming times and our swim meets, and asked me about how do you serve process and Florida rules of civil procedure, was quizzing me back and forth from social things we had done and parties in college and so on. He says, okay, I'm satisfied. He says, you can practice law. I said, Jesse, I can't even stand up. He says, that doesn't matter. You'll get that back. You're alert. You remember. You still know your statutes and your Florida rules of civil procedure. You'll be fine. I was really dumbfounded and confused. I barely knew before Jesse got there that I was a lawyer. I had a little right frontal lobe brain damage. It was confusing about what I would do. So around September 28th or 30th, I decided, you know, I think I'll get my caregiver to take me over to the office. I still had a trach and I believe an IV, a lot of medical equipment. Got to the office and sat back in my chair and started fielding some phone calls about whether I was going to return. I kept getting more and more phone calls, and to my surprise, some of my clients had actually gone to visit me in traumatic intensive care. I didn't remember that. And I gradually got up to 2 hours a day and 4 hours a day and 6 hours a day. I did my first hearing, a summary judgment hearing. I still remember it. November 2nd, 2004. I memorized my case law because I couldn't read it. So I tried to impress the judge that I knew something by memorizing some citations. And probably by January and February, I had learned to effectively type with a program called JAWS, which is job-assisted word systems, and listen to depositions and briefs with something called Kurzweil. It worked out pretty well, and things started to advance, and I made gradual progress. An injury such as this is catastrophic, and whether it's a heart attack or a car accident or a shooting such as I suffered, there's an awful lot of trauma associated with it. If you focus on your trauma and your panic, you don't go anywhere. So you need to sit back and think about where you want to go and what you want to do and what is the best thing. Are you going to sit around and do nothing for the rest of your life? Or are you going to do or try and do good thing for your clients, your staff, and get back and do what you were doing before? And I've worked hard to accomplish that. I have virtually no usable vision. I sometimes recognize a big pillar or something that goes by my face, but there's no vision.
Okay, so that's it. I think it's really just an amazing story of resilience. Now, this interview was obviously done in relation to working in the law and more focused on his career. But I think it's pretty amazing. It was, what, like a month since the shooting and he was back at work?
Yeah, impressive. Now, when asked in a 2010 interview if he is open to a reconciliation with his son, John was quoted as saying, "That ain't happening. No way."
Well, I don't see how you can do that when Christopher has not apologized or confessed. He's maintaining his innocence. So I think there's no way to move forward with that situation. It's a standoff.
No, I think he has to own up for his responsibility in this.
Absolutely. I agree. But that hasn't happened. So it's interesting to note that Christopher is not the only young man from a troubled teen program to end up committing murder. So I find this just fascinating. As a child, Evan Ebel had behavioral problems, and eventually his parents sent him to several programs for children with problems, and this began when he was 12. But the camps only seemed to worsen Ebel's behavioral problems. In 2002, when he was 18, Ebel was arrested for holding a guy at gunpoint and stealing his wallet. He was later charged with committing two other armed robberies and sentenced to 8 years in prison in 2005. In prison, he was actually given the nickname Evil Ebel and spent most of his sentence in solitary. Ebel had become part of a white supremacist prison gang whose members were responsible for the 1997 death of an African immigrant. In 2006, he was disciplined for smearing feces on his cell wall and punching an inmate and a prison guard. He also threatened to kill the guard's family. And 2 years later, Ebel pleaded guilty and he was sentenced to an additional 4 years. But then, on January 28, 2013, he was suddenly released from prison. This was 4 years early because prison officials saw his court records and somehow didn't notice that the plea deal included an extended sentence for him. Once free, Ebel got a 9mm pistol from a friend, whom he manipulated into buying it since he, a felon, couldn't purchase a firearm. Then almost 2 months after his release, on March 22nd, he shot and killed a pizza delivery man for Domino's, Nathan Leon, in Denver, Colorado. He stole Leon's uniform, too. And 2 days later, he was wearing the uniform when he went to the home of Thomas Lynn Clements. And when Clements answered the door, Ebel shot him in the chest, killing him. 2 days after that, Ebel was seen in his car in Wise County, Texas. He was pulled over by Deputy James Boyd, whom he shot and wounded in the head before he took off. Then there was a car chase, and Ebel fired out of his window at police officers. He ended up accidentally crashing his car into a truck, but he got out and continued firing his gun at the officers. So he was shot and critically wounded by the police and ended up dying in the hospital at age 28.
Then there's the case of Joshua Lambert, who was sent to Paradise Cove when he was just 15 years old. He killed both of his grandfathers in two different homes in 2011. He has been diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder.
So there are three murderers that we know of who attended one of these tough love, troubled teen programs. But many more young men came out of the programs emotionally scarred, and several have reported suffering from PTSD.
One story shared by activist Bill Boyles, who runs the Paradise Cove Survivors website, was about when a rumor spread at one program that if a boy died, the rest of them could all go home. Now, these kids were so desperate to leave that they decided to cause the death of one of the teens. They plotted to drown or stab the youngest boy in that program. Fortunately, he survived. Former residents had been linked to 11 suicides or overdose deaths in addition to the three who committed murders.
So it's, of course, impossible to say that these programs caused this to happen because these were troubled young men to begin with. But I'd certainly say that it didn't help.
It did not help.
Did not help at all. Very disturbing. So it's just really a shame that there wasn't some kind of help that could be given to Christopher that may have prevented this tragedy. But, you know, a lot of young men who survived these programs did not become killers or abusive in any way.
No.
So I think there has to be more to it. I don't think these programs create murderers.
Well, like a lot of things, I think you have to have the right set of circumstances to produce what happens.
Yeah.
So you have a susceptible person and a program designed to inflame those susceptible people.
Exactly. Well, and these are people who needed help and didn't get it. That's the basic part of it to begin with.
Yeah.
Okay, so thank you to Nate for recommending this case.
And happy birthday, Nate.
Happy birthday, Nate. TCB's music is written and produced by our nephew, Tristan Capel. You can send your comments, case suggestions, and beer recommendations to us by email to truecrimebrewery@tiegrabber.com or in a voicemail. There is a link in our show notes and also on our website, so you can record your voicemail right from your device, and we love to get them. If you are someone who's interested in getting your future TCB episodes without commercials and listening to our extra members-only episode each month, plus getting a gift and a note from us, you might want to consider subscribing as a Tie Grabber by going to our website, tiegrabber.com, and you can do that for as cheap as $4 a month. Pretty good deal.
Can't go wrong.
No. We also have merch at our shop at tiegrabber.com/shop. If you want to get yourself a t-shirt or a sweatshirt, something with our logo on it just to support the show, we'd appreciate that. So Dickie is here with feedback. What have we got this week?
The usual. I have a couple voicemails and an email. The first voicemail is from Bex. She has like three voicemails in a row.
And this is another case suggestion.
And it is another case suggestion.
Hey, Dick and Jill, this is Bex. I am calling with a case recommendation. And I checked. I don't think you've done this case. It is the murder of Patricia Burns. And she lived in Lake Luzerne, New York. This happened in 2013 after she was married for 15 years. And the murderer pled guilty and then wanted to change his mind later. So there was an investigation discovery episode called Signs of a Psychopath that featured this case. And it's just a very interesting story. I think you find plenty of information about it out there. So I wanted to suggest it. I'm not going to give too much away. But yeah, take a look and see if it's something you'd be interested in doing. Thanks, and happy 2022.
Well, thanks, Bex. Happy 2022 to you, as well as all of our other listeners.
Yeah, this is a case we've heard about. We haven't done anything, and I'm going to do like Bex did and not say anything more so as not to give the details away. But okay. I think it's one that'd be worthy of a look over and see if we want to do it.
Okay, that sounds great. So our next voicemail is from Elle.
Yes, and Elle had back-to-back voicemails. This is the oldest of the two.
Hi, I'm Elle, and I'm sending this voice message from Bedfordshire in the UK. I really wanted to recommend a case to you. I know that you have this reticence about recording and dealing with podcast cases with respect to children, but I think this is a really important story that needs to be told, and it's one that caught the UK nation's attention and created this sort of collective grief a couple of months ago when we were told about the absolutely horrific case of the six-year-old boy called Arthur Libigno Hughes. And he was, I don't want to give too much of the case away, but he was murdered by his stepmother with the consent of the father. The little boy went to live with his father after his mother had gone to prison for the murder of her partner a couple of years earlier. And this little boy was systematically abused throughout the period of time that he was living with his father and his stepmother. You can see videos, video recordings, audio recordings rather, online of him crying. They recorded him saying that nobody loved him, he was unloved, and that he was never going to be fed. They fed him salt. They made him stand for hours at a time. They made him sleep on the floor. The little boy was tormented, and he was a absolutely beautiful little boy. And his extended family tried to do everything to get social services to intervene. And in fact, I think it was the uncle went to the police during the first lockdown that we had here and said that he was going to check up on the little boy because the little boy had said that he was unloved to the uncle, and the police threatened the uncle with arrest if he broke lockdown rules. And the father would text the stepmother when he was at work or when he was outside, telling the stepmother to end him, I'm going to take his jaw off when I get home, just, you know. So he was sort of coercing and encouraging his girlfriend to harm the little boy, which she ultimately did. Coming to the end of the nearly 3 minutes, I know, as I said, it's a case that you don't tend to like to take on, but I really, if anything, if nothing else, please look at the case. I think it's a really important case. In terms of beers, I can't recommend anything, and I don't think the UK has that many great beers anyway, does it? I'm not really a beer drinker. I do drink the occasional cider every now and again. But I love your show. I love you both, and thank you for what you do. Thank you.
Thank you, Al. I'm just really upset just hearing that, I have to say.
Yeah, I think I'll look into it, but just from what Al has said, I'm not sure I want to do a case that's going to talk about systematic torture of five or six-year-old.
Right, exactly. It's horrific. But on the other hand, why did this happen? And I think that's what Al is saying, is we do need to look at why these things happen to prevent it from happening again.
It's
very disturbing.
Yeah.
It's not something you want to sit and talk about the details of abuse. But on the other hand, it might be good to talk about the situation and the circumstances under which such a horrible thing can occur. But yes, I understand. It's just soul crushing to just even think about it.
Right.
Dreadful. And you just want to murder those people.
Yes.
Really sick. But thank you, Al. I understand what you're saying with that, and we will at least look into it and see if it's something that we could be productive in discussing.
We will.
I think that's fair. Okay, so Al also sent us an email with some more information, which we won't talk about right now. We'll just look into the case, and then maybe we can bring that up a little later.
We might be able to.
Okay.
And then we do have our token email from Amy.
Okay, you want to read that one?
Sure. Amy wants to discuss murder in 2020 in Wasilla, Alaska. Malachi Maxson, who is 18, was charged with 4 counts of first-degree murder in the shooting deaths of his aunt and 3 cousins, aged 18, 10, and 7. His bail was set at $10 million. So in July 2020, after allegedly attacking his mother at her home in Wasilla, Maxson was charged with domestic violence assault and interfering with a report of a domestic violence crime. On October 2020, Maxson allegedly attacked his stepfather, which resulted in charges of criminal mischief, domestic violence assault, and violating conditions of release. After 3 weeks in custody, he was released on a $200 bail and ordered to wear an ankle monitor. November of 2020, he was charged with 2 counts of misdemeanor domestic violence assault and criminal mischief stemming from a confrontation with his uncle at his grandmother's home. November 23rd of 2020, he was released on $500 cash bail and a $2,500 unsecured bond. December of 2020, Maxson is accused of murdering his cousin, 18-year-old Cody Roll, at a home near Wasilla, where he stole a vehicle and a semi-automatic Glock pistol. He then drove about 13 miles to the city of Palmer, where he broke into the basement of his and 2 cousins' house. Upon arrival, police found the body of Maxson's 43-year-old aunt, Kimora Busters. They also found the body of 7-year-old Ellison Buster, dead in his bed, and 10-year-old Sienna Buster, injured in her bed. Sienna later died at a hospital.
Wow, that's a tragedy.
So this is quite a spree.
Yes.
And I hadn't done much looking at it other than to write it down.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if this is a troubled kid who'd been having problems for years, like present case that we're doing, or if this is something that he just kind of snapped.
I don't know.
Because it's all clustered in like a 2 or 3 month period.
Have we ever done an Alaska case? I'm thinking maybe we did one.
We have.
Yeah, I'm thinking of an exotic dancer that lived up there and killed at least one man. I can't remember the names. There's too many cases, but I think we've only done one Alaska case in the past several years.
Yeah, one or two.
I wonder if they have much for beer in Alaska.
Oh, they do.
Do they?
Yes.
Oh, so it might be worth it. Okay, well, let's look into that. And can you just share with people? We have something kind of exciting coming up in the next week or two. And this is the kind of thing I've wanted to do by going back to doing a case every other week. We can do little extra things like this.
Well, you might remember the episode called Pam's Path to Prison.
Yes, Pam Hupp.
About Pam Hupp,
mm-hmm.
who murdered a person and is going to be standing trial for the murder of Betsy Faria. This was a whole episode we did where Betsy's husband, Russ, was convicted of the murder. Served 4 years in prison, finally got a new trial, and was acquitted. And now Pam is going to be going on trial. But we will be interviewing Joel Schwartz, who is Russ's attorney, whose diligence and hard work got him free after he was first convicted. But we're going to be interviewing Joel to get his thoughts and comments on the case. It's absolutely fascinating.
Yes, yeah, so he does have a book coming out that we've been able to read before it's released. What's that called?
That's Bone Deep.
And that's written by Joel Schwartz and...
Yeah, and he has a co-author.
Okay.
But it's an absolutely fascinating story, and the book is an absolutely fascinating book. Going to interview him in a couple weeks, and then we'll put out a episode for everybody to hear.
Yeah, that'll be great. It'll be out this month.
Yes.
Okay.
It will be out in February.
And I was going to recommend, if you haven't heard that episode, maybe go back and look for it. Our episode on this is called Pam's Path to Prison. Also, though, there are 5 Dateline episodes just on this case. So you might want to watch some of those if you hadn't, because it really is a fascinating case.
Twists and turns you won't believe.
Yes. And I know I say that about a lot of cases, but this one really takes the cake.
Well, and as the Dateline people say, they've done 5 episodes on this particular case. The only crimes that have garnered more episodes on Dateline are the JonBenet case and the OJ case. So Pam's up there with some elite company.
I guess so. I bet that the Daybell case is getting close, though. I think they've done at least 3 on that.
Yeah, that might be a contender.
It might be, yeah. But anyway, that's something to look forward to. And I'd just like to thank all of you for listening and for your support and for your feedback. We really do appreciate that very much.
Very, very much.
Yes. So we'll see you next time at the quiet end.
We got extra seats down here.
We do, although Nate and his buddies.
Yeah, they're hardcore, aren't they?
They really are. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye, guys.